Good afternoon, Your Honors. Carolyn Blanchard for Mr. Owens. My registration number is 34066. This case essentially circles around the prosecution's charge of at-risk juvenile, and the errors begin prior to trial, we saw motions all the way through jury instructions. Duro was around 12 years old when she lived with her father, Mr. Owens, for about a year. After she returned to her maternal aunt's, which was her residence prior to living with her father, she made allegations of sexual abuse about maybe 6 to 8 months later. The first pretrial motion, well, the two pretrial motions that I think are in error, that judge abused his discretion, was the defense request of psychological examination of DO and a competency evaluation of DO. And in both of these situations, the judge relied on a statute which really didn't apply to this young woman, because it specified that the young woman or the child had to be under 10 years old in order to essentially avoid some of the requirements of a competency evaluation.
Also, let me just stop you there for a minute. As I read the record, the court relied on the statute that you are referencing with respect to his consideration of the competency determination, but I didn't see any reference that he relied on that statute with respect to the request for a psych evaluation.
Well, I think it was in my reply brief. One of my briefs, I mentioned that the sentence just before the prosecution or the AG used in to reply to me, so it must have been in my reply brief, that the judge cited a statute number, but it didn't make any sense. Either he said the wrong number, it was recorded incorrectly, and I can only presume, since he referred to the same the statute when he was doing competency, addressing the competency issue, that he must have meant that statute, the statute 1390106. So that's, otherwise the judge's comment wouldn't have made any sense, or at least I couldn't make any sense of it. The last three numbers, the 106, were the same. So I say that's abuse of discretion. The judge didn't follow the law. And this denied my client's right to present a defense. He had no access to this young woman. This young woman refused to have a physical exam. Three times she was taken and refused. My client never made any admissions. There's no other corroboration of any sort other than this young woman's testimony. Then we have the testimony of the aunt. I submit that this was impermissible lay testimony because it was based on scientific evidence or technical evidence. The technical evidence is someone had to evaluate DO in order to place her in special ed. Someone had give her tests, and only on these evaluations and these tests did the aunt get the information that this young woman was mildly mentally retarded or mildly retarded and had a developmental disability. So I submit that was impermissible testimony, and the judge abused his discretion in permitting that testimony. Further, there were uncharged acts. The case started out with a little bit of sex, to just shorten the discussion. A little bit of sex, it happened three or four times. That's her alleged original statement to her aunt. Prior to that, she had been given an interview after she had been removed from her father's home and denied that there was any sexual contact. And then about, well, the day or two before trial, she makes allegations of all these additional sexual contacts. And this is about 4 years after she's removed from her father's home. Maybe 3 to 4 years. I lose track of time in these long cases. And she makes allegations that there was sexual contact before the date charged in the information, before April 1st, 2001. Because there was testimony that they lived at two different addresses, and so it was known that April 1, they lived at one address, and before April 1, they lived at a different address. And so the jury heard all this information about sexual contacts take three times a week before April 1st, which was because it was located at a different address than the address that they lived at after April 1st.
How were you, there was, near as I can tell, there was no contemporaneous objection to this. So, and there was vigorous cross-examination of the victim on all her inconsistencies and all of her statements. So how were you prejudiced by this?
Well, because the comment, all the young woman said, all DO said was, I don't remember. I don't remember whenever defense counsel attempted to, shall we say, pin her down to why her statements were different. I don't remember. Although DO had said all three of her statements, well, the prior two statements were the truth, and allegedly, well, we don't know because they're, no one assessed this young woman's competency. We don't know if she understood the duty required by the oath to tell the truth.
But that's a different issue. She had never put a specific date on any of the alleged acts. So how, at the end of the day, if you had the ability to cross-examine her on all these inconsistencies, and there was no contemporaneous objection to this, to the most recent story, how is it that your client was prejudiced? I understand the whole competency issue, but beyond that, where's the harm?
Well, because I cited a case from the Supreme Court, I think, I can't say the name. The judge, justice ruled that a judge has a duty to sua sponte give an instruction on uncharged acts.
But if they're not uncharged acts, the people argued in response to your motion for new trial, and they argue on appeal that this was nothing more than a simple variance, and it was just new evidence about charged acts.
Well, it's outside the time limit. April 1st was the break point in this time limit. And she claimed that it happened at the residence that they lived at before April 1st.
Don't we have cases that say if all it is a change in the time frame, that's not a constructive amendment. It's just a simple variance.
Well, I apologize to the courts. I don't know if I agree with that. I don't know that case law, so I can't respond to that. But and May 5th, which is about maybe 2 months before trial, when the defense is given an information and the amended, more specific information, that there's three or four instances of sex, and then suddenly the day before trial we come into 350 or more instances.
There wasn't a request for continuance, though, on that basis, I take it.
Not that I saw, Judge. There's also, the sufficiency of the evidence issue. And the problem of, was it proven? Just simply, was it proven that this was an at-risk juvenile?
Ask you about that a little bit. There's a couple of issues in the case having to do with the finding of at-risk. And your brief is a little bit unclear about this. I mean, if we were to agree with you on any of those issues, what's the remedy here? Because isn't the at-risk determination a sentence enhancement? And so would it require a new trial here, or could the conviction still stand, but there would have to be resentencing on the counts because the at-risk enhancement would go away? And that was unclear in your briefs.
Well, I think it requires a new trial because based on this at-risk charge, the prosecution brought in this expert who said, this is how mildly retarded people respond to these kind of activities in their lives. And they might, you know, give a statement now and then a statement 2 years later and a statement 4 years later, and that's pretty normal. So I think that all that expert testimony was terribly prejudicial in this case and permitted the jury to enhance or just have information that they shouldn't have had, and which made the jury's decision improper.
Same expert testify that she was a developmentally disabled child, or did she just assume that? I'm confused about whether the testimony that she was at risk is based solely on the aunt's testimony or on the expert's as well.
Solely on the aunt's testimony.
So how did the expert testify that she was developmentally disabled? I don't understand.
Well, I may have misspoke, but the expert testified about how developmentally disabled people relay information, not specifically how this DO relays information.
But she didn't examine DO?
Correct.
Okay. She was just testifying in the, as a hypothetical expert witness?
Correct.
Okay.
But she did testify, or yet he or she, I believe it was a he, testified that a DO was capable of deception, which I think is a very important little tidbit in this case.
That was after her competency had already been established, though, I take it. That wasn't part of the competency.
Well, nobody addressed competency. The judge never, no questions were asked of this young woman.
Prior to trial
or at trial, there wasn't a little thing. She was just given the oath. No, the judge never asked, do you know white from black, and do you know what a lie is?
But the judge did look at the videotapes of the interviews.
Yes.
And did have the pretrial testimony of both the aunt and the expert. And said so when he made his competency determination, didn't he?
Yes.
Okay.
I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
Absolutely. You've got about 2 minutes.
May it please the court, Catherine Idala, registration number 39218, representing the people. I'll try to touch on all of the issues that defense counsel brought up in her argument. I guess I'll just start with the independent psychological examination, the first issue. In the opening brief, the defendant argued that the court should have ordered a psychological examination because there was no corroboration of the victim's testimony. Her allegations were inconsistent, and she added more sexual assaults than originally disclosed. And these things simply are not grounds for an independent psychological examination, which requires a showing of a compelling need. This court is aware that, you know, inconsistent allegations are a factor in, I mean, many, if not most, sexual assault on a child cases, and there's really nothing unique about this case. The defendant acknowledged he was provided with documentation of the victim's developmental disability, and, you know, to the extent that he claims that wasn't specific enough, it was his burden to, you know, show what was lacking, and, you know, I responded in my brief, I don't know what information was provided or to be able to respond to the defendant's claim that it was inadequate. I think that this case is very similar to established case law. I think it was the Pirro case, and there's just simply not a showing of a compelling need in this case. All of the issues the defendant raises were matters for cross-examination, and this victim was extensively cross-examined on her inconsistent allegations. The court has no questions on that issue. I'll address the competence issue. The rule is that a witness is presumed competent to testify, and it was the defendant's burden to overcome this presumption. And again, you know, in the defendant's brief, it's more argument that the victim wasn't consistent in her allegations. And I think this is really confusing the issue of competence and consistency. And consistency or inconsistency is a matter for cross-examination. And I think, you know, how the trial court chose to evaluate the victim's competence was within its discretion. There isn't any set litany that the court needs to go through. And the court relied on the forensic interviewer's, the video of the forensic interviewer's interview with the victim, and the victim's Aunt Gail, who was essentially, you know, her parent or guardian's testimony about the victim's level of functioning. And I think this was very reasonable to do that because, you know, those two witnesses were equipped to judge the victim's ability to observe, recollect, and communicate. And I think, you know, if this court is looking for further evidence on the competency issue, I think the victim's trial testimony provides support that she was competent. I mean, at the very beginning of her testimony, she, you know, describes where she lives, the classes she takes, her friends, when she was living with the defendant, and what the, you know, description of the house is. I mean, and that's showing that she's able to observe and relate events that have happened to her.
So let me ask you a question about the competency issue. Separate and apart from what the record may show, didn't the, in terms of the court's reasoning, how the legal standard that he applied, would you agree that it appears that he, because she was older than 10 years old, he applied the wrong legal standard? Now, the record still may support his ultimate determination, but it strikes me that he kind of got it wrong on the legal standard.
You know, it's a little bit unclear. I mean, I was going through the statute and I read the Sechrist case, which is what the court references in its ruling. And when it really seems to me like that, you know, that Sechrist case is really neither here nor there, because the court cites the statute for dealing with a child under 10, and certainly I would agree that we don't have a child under 10 here, but that really references, you know, a different standard to, you know, that we apply with children under 10. So the fact that she's not under 10 doesn't really mean anything, and I think the court still made sufficient findings to support a ruling that she's competent. I think
we would have to apply the correct standard under any event, correct? I mean, we couldn't apply that statute here as the...
No, and I'm certainly not asking you to, because I would agree that it doesn't make sense with the facts of this case, but I do think there's sufficient evidence in the record and in the statements that the court made, even though it referenced a case that doesn't really seem to fit here. I think if there are no other questions on that issue, I'll address the, the improper expert testimony claim. And this is also, again, just a reminder of plain error standard of review, as many of these claims are. I think Aunt Gail's testimony about the victim's cognitive level was permissible lay testimony because Aunt Gail is essentially the victim's mother. And she's raised the victim. She knows. She's observed her. She's lived with her. She knows what she's capable of. And she's participated in, you know, the special ed evaluations. And I think these are things that a parent knows about his or her child, and that's the standard for, you know, expert testimony, whether it results from a process of reasoning familiar in everyday life. And I think it's quite familiar for a parent to know the cognitive functioning of their child.
So Aunt Gail testified, if I'm correct, that this young woman was, quote, mildly retarded. That was basically the opinion she gave?
That was one statement she made in the context of, you know, pretty extensive testimony about the victim's functioning, but I think that the quote she used, I mean, was mildly
so retarded. Assuming that she was qualified to give that opinion, does that satisfy the statutory standard to establish that this young woman was an at-risk victim?
Sure, would you like me to address the sufficiency issue?
I guess I just jumped you ahead in one
issue,
but maybe the other judges have questions.
I'm not sure to address it, but okay. You know, on the sufficiency issue, I think there's certainly enough evidence. And I don't think that it was simply just based on that one statement from Aunt Gail. Aunt Gail gave a lot of testimony about the victim's functioning. And when you're looking at the statute, it sort of at risk leads you to several different definitions where we get to a substantial disability. But, you know, there's nothing in the statute or our case law that I could find that says that we need, you know, medical or expert testimony on this issue. You know, I compared this to serious bodily injury. We don't need expert testimony for that. And I think there's substantial evidence that this girl was quite disabled. She couldn't keep up with the other kids in school. She'd been a special ed student since the moment she entered school. She was the child of a mother who was, and this was unobjected to testimony, that her mother was moderately retarded and unable to live on her own, which is the reason that Aunt Gail is raising the victim in the first place. And then I think quite compelling testimony just in was that the victim functioned at the level of a fourth grader. So, you know, an 8 or 9 year old, even though she's a 17 year old and entering her senior year of high school. So, you know, I think that's pretty substantial. And, you know, just one final point on this issue. You know, none of us here had the ability to observe the victim's testimony. And you know, the jury did. They had the opportunity to observe her demeanor and her ability to communicate on the stand. And I think those observations certainly must have influenced its determination that she was developmentally disabled.
The evidence that she functioned as a fourth grader, again, solely came from the aunt's testimony about what she had been observed about the child, I guess, or told about the child based on what happened at school.
Yeah, and you know, just as far as what she was told in school, you know, I'm not even sure the extent that the record really supports this, that all of what Aunt Gail learned about the victim was from something that a psychologist told her in school. You know, I think Aunt Gail was certainly.
And that raises the Crawford issue that the defendant.
No, I really don't see that it does so, because I mean, I don't see a confrontation problem here because. I mean, there's no testimonial evidence being provided by some kind of school psychologist who may have examined her. You know, there's no evidence that it was in anticipation of trial. I mean, Crawford, where confrontation is dealing with testimonial evidence. I mean, I think if anything, it may have been a hearsay issue to the extent that Aunt Gail was relaying something that a psychologist told her, but I don't even think that's clear from the record, and it certainly doesn't rise to the level of plain error when we're considering that none of this testimony was objected to.
As you turn to the issue of the evidence of the other sexual assaults, as indicated by counsel, we have a situation where the information, I guess, addressed really 4 discrete incidents in a time frame. And then literally on the eve of trial, as I understand it, after another interview, the prosecution informs the defense that they've just learned that she now is sort of recounting that there were numerous sexual assaults virtually every day for a period of time which preceded the time that's in the information. When that evidence comes in, is that evidence permissible? Is it in fact evidence of charged conduct, or is it similar bad acts evidence? What's the basis for allowing that?
Certainly. Well, I argued in my brief that this is evidence of the charged crimes. I don't think there was any argument here that this evidence was admitted. I think the testimony was that, and this was the victim's testimony, that the defendant assaulted her 3 times a week at the one house where they lived, and then it was every day or almost every day at another house. That was evidence of the charged crimes, and it certainly wasn't, you know, offered or argued to show that the defendant had a propensity to commit sexual assault, or to show that he had a bad character.
Did the jury have convicted on the basis of that conduct that was first added, if you will, on the eve of trial?
I'm sorry, I didn't.
Could the jury base its conviction on the conduct that occurred before the time period that's covered by the information?
You know, I don't think there was ever an objection to dates being outside the charged dates. I think Judge Lowe brought up with defense counsel that in sexual assault cases, the date isn't a material allegation. And to be honest, I didn't catch that from the opening brief. It seemed to me that was something that came out for the first time in the reply brief, that it was outside the charged dates. I thought I sort of saw this more as a 404B issue from what the defense was arguing. But I think the important thing is that this testimony was admissible because it was relevant. If we want to say it wasn't evidence of the charged crimes, I mean, The defendant's theory of the case is that the victim's allegations were a complete lie, and, you know, this was evidenced by all of her inconsistent statements. And I think that, you know, when you're dealing with a sexual assault on a child case, this offers an explanation other than that the victim lied. And that's, you know, it's difficult to remember where and when the defendant sexually assaulted her, because there's evidence that he did it on so many different occasions that she couldn't keep it all straight. So I think on either of those bases, the evidence was admissible.
It's a pretty dramatic change from 3 or 4 times to what I guess would literally be hundreds of times based on the last version, as she tells it on the eve of trial.
No, it certainly, it is a change, but I think, you know, there was expert testimony explaining why child sexual assault victims sometimes gradually disclose abuse, just to make that, you know, understandable to the jury, that that's something that, you know, happens from time to time in this situation.
Let me follow up on that a little bit, because it's not at all clear to me from the record that this was a change. Aunt Gail testified that the victim told her about this frequency early on in the game, but there doesn't seem to be any indication that the prosecution ever knew about it until shortly before trial itself. Is that ever explained or talked about in the record at all? Because Aunt Gail testified clearly that the victim told her early on that it happened with this level of frequency. So I'm trying to figure out how that got buried all those years.
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure, and to be honest, I don't want to misstate the record, because I don't recall specifically what Aunt Gail's testimony is as far as the time frame that the victim told her about the allegations. And I do remember Aunt Gail testified that it to the same thing that the victim did, that it was, you know, 3 to 4 times a week. But there was an email from the prosecutor to defense counsel shortly before trial, you know, saying that, you know, the victim had made additional disclosures that were provided to the defense. I think I've covered all of the issues that defense counsel raised. Does the court have any further questions? Okay. Well, in that case, the people would request that you affirm the defendant's conviction and sentence.
Thank you, counsel. Blanchard, you got a little over 2 minutes, I think.
Thank you. I'll address this Aunt Gail issue. Just before trial, when the prosecutor interviewed D.O., I guess, couldn't remember how many times this occurred. I guess this may have come from the emails. And the prosecutor asked Aunt Gail to see if she could clarify how many times this really occurred with D.O. And then that's how this 3 to 4 times a week at the first residence and it came about. And I believe when Aunt Gail testified at trial, she sort of conflated everything and said she knew about it. But she only learned about it, I believe, from my review of the record, when the prosecutor did, just a few days before trial.
What's the legal issue here then? Whether there was a variance from the indictment? Is that what you're suggesting, that this was a variance from what was charged? But then you have to show us some prejudice from that. So Judge Loeb has asked you to define for us what the prejudice, this was a technical variance. What was the prejudice from the different acts? He was the number of counts weren't increased. He was still only convicted of 4 counts.
Well, so the jury...
It helped them, actually, probably.
The jury never was given a unanimity instruction, despite being requested. And the jury was charged with Act 1, 2, 3, and 4, which was never referred to at trial. Suddenly, in the jury instructions, the jury's told to make a determination what is Act 1, 2, 3, and 4, but they were...
The defendant never said, I didn't do 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 or 7 or 8. He said, I didn't do any of these. So if the jury believed the victim, it didn't make any difference, did it? We can affirm on the grounds that the jury couldn't have disagreed on what the act was.
Well,
it wasn't his defense that I didn't do some of these acts, but I did others. Correct. His defense was,
that's the defense.
I didn't do any of these.
What could his defense be if he didn't do it? I mean, that's the only thing the man could say. I didn't do it. I didn't do any of them. But the jury, I think, has to be told they have to at least agree that Okay, we agree they did all of them. They were, but the jury wasn't even told that.
But doesn't the law say, don't the cases say in Colorado that there's no reasonable probability that the jury was, they were either going to believe him or they're going to believe her?
Yes, I agree that's what the law says, but I don't agree maybe that's how people think.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your oral arguments. The case will stand submitted. An opinion will issue in due course.